Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. I don't know if you'll agree with me, but I'm guessing that not only are our listeners listening to us, but nowadays you never know who else might be listening to these conversations. It could be that infamous NSO Pegasus police state that we now live in here in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've discussed this on the podcast in the past that Google has warned me that state actors have been trying to get into my email. So I, for a long time, have had that feeling that Big Brother is watching, but it turns out that Big Brother is watching a lot of people that it shouldn't be.
And also Big Brother might not be some state or foreign actor. It could actually be the Israeli policeman who you wave at in the morning as you take your kids to school, for all you know,
yeah.
Right? I don't think that we knew that the police were doing what they are being accused of doing, which is listening to director generals of government ministries, politicians, mayors of cities, journalists, leaders of protest movements, the son of the prime minister. I mean, this is literally insane. These reports that have come out, and you have to tap our hats to Tomer Gonen, the reporter from the Israeli economic newspaper Kalkalist, who has been breaking these stories. Whoever's feeding him this stuff, wow! But he's getting scoop after scoop on NSO and the use of spyware by the Israel police over the last few weeks, which is, I would say, earth-shattering. Yeah. To consider that in a democracy, the police can do whatever the hell they want.
It's a huge story. People are really outraged by this. And yeah, and in a democracy, the police are supposed to, if they're going to, you know, listen to someone's phone calls or look at someone's emails, they're supposed to have a warrant. They're supposed to have permission from a judge. And it appears, I mean, there's still, you know, the government is looking into it. And Tomer Gonen said that that they did not have warrants for these. You know, I don't doubt Tomer Gonen's reporting, but I do think it is worth pointing out that he doesn't really say where he's getting any of this information from. And so the government is going to check this in some kind of way. I do think that it reaches the level of a commission of inquiry, which is sort of what the Israeli government does when it wants to investigate really, really seriously problematic things, including, you know, the Yom Kippur War, you know, like that level. But I think that for a democracy, this is massively problematic, and it does reach that level. What do you think?
Look, I think there's a couple of issues here at play, potentially. I mean, first of all, is the fact that obviously this undermines a basic civil liberties that we have as citizens of a country, the fact that people can just decide to download and suck everything off our phones because, I don't know, they're going on some fishing expedition, even if they don't have any suspicions against us, is itself ludicrous. To do that against government employees and journalists and people who are exercising their basic right to protest is nauseating. In addition to that, though, I think we do have to recognize that the Israel police is a force and is an institution that has long been broken over decades. First of all, and I know policemen, some of them are really amazing people, but the human capital there is not known for being of a high quality. The over the years, we've seen commander after commander have to step down because of corruption and because of sexual allegations.
A lot of sexual allegations in the past decade or so.
Right. Remember that one year that there were like five or six of their top officers who one after the other had to quit amid serious sexual allegations against them.
Here's the crazy thing. At the moment, it seems that most of this NSO spying stuff happened under Roni Alshech when he was chief of police. Now, Roni Alshech was the deputy head of the Shabak, and the Shabak uses these kinds of tools against Palestinians and others that are sort of external security threats on Israel, right? And he was brought in because there was no one, the feeling was that the police was so corrupt that they had to bring someone from the outside to fix things. And then now you have someone who is corrupt in a different way. I mean, he just does not, you know, the system does not respect the values of a democracy and the privacy and the right to privacy of the citizens that's supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, but you know, there's also problems, and there's legislative issues also in Israel, right? in the United States, for example, and I hope I'm getting this right, but there's the legal principle of the fruit from the poisonous tree, right? Or the poisonous fruit from the forbidden tree.
I don't know
tree.
If that's the expression in English. I know that's what they say in Hebrew, but yeah.
No. There's a version okay. of that in English. Google it as I explain it right now.
I learned that. We both went to college in Hebrew. Like, I learned that too, but I don't remember it in English. But okay, I take your word for it.
No. I'm telling you that it is the fruit of the poisonous tree. Okay. That's what it is. It's a rule. It's a doctrine in criminal law. That's what it's called. Fruit of the poisonous tree. And basically, if you get evidence the wrong way, right? You do it in an illegal way. Then all that evidence is bad. You can't use it. But in Israel, we don't have that. And that's how, for example, the police could go on these fishing expeditions. They could get some information. They could then pass it on to investigators and say, hey, you know, we just got this from a source we don't know. Why don't you guys look into this a little more? And that could lead to who knows what. And the whole thing was corrupt to begin with. But there is not that basic principle in Israeli law. And I know that Gideon Saar, the current justice minister, has long spoken about passing some sort of legislation on that matter. So it itself is an issue that we have a lacuna in our legal system. But I think we also have a police force that for so long has been neglected, is not drawing the right type of people. And let's also be honest, Lahav, and I don't want to make it seem like Bibi's responsible for everything, but during his term of, what was it, 12, 13 years
yes.
consecutive in office, that was a long period that he did actively try to weaken the police force, but, you know, the police was never something that this country invested in. It wasn't under Bibi, and it wasn't even the years before Bibi. And, you know, it's not like the IDF, it's not like the Shabaka, and it's not like the Mossad. So you get what you pay for.
Definitely.
And I don't think we should be surprised.
No, I agree. I would only blame Netanyahu in the terms of neglect, as in, like, the police, they're not as interesting or as prestigious to people. And so I think he just didn't care about it, didn't want to think about it that much. But, you know, that neglect has smacked him in the face, right? Because a lot of this hacking, including of his son's phone, you know, are of people close to Netanyahu, people involved in Netanyahu's current criminal proceedings. You know, and his lawyers are trying to use it to throw the case out. And I know that Yona Bob, our legal reporter, thinks that's not going to happen. But certainly, you know, we're all learning the lesson.
Although, I mean, it's important to mention, you mentioned Avner Netanyahu, that's his second son, who is less politically active like the older son, Yair, but is, you know, definitely the son of the former prime minister, that his phone was apparently targeted. But also we know that Shlomo Filber, who was a very close associate once upon a time of the prime minister and served as the director general of the communications ministry when this whole Yes Bezek thing went down to some extent, that he was also targeted. So we know that this was apparently used in the framework of the investigations against the prime minister. And I think that Bibi, of course, is trying to use this to maybe taint those investigations and some of the evidence that is being brought against him. And you know what? He might have a case. Forget about what you think about Netanyahu, but this can't be done, right? And I think that that's what, you know, putting aside the Netanyahu case, this is a severe violation of basic civil liberties in the state of Israel. Every citizen of this country should be concerned that these kind of things can happen. And I hope that that somehow they're able to get to the bottom of this. You know, what was telling to me, Lahav, is that yesterday, so we're talking now on Tuesday. So on Monday, Kobi Shabtai, the police commissioner himself, called for an investigation and asked that it be external. Right. In other words, he's not saying, oh, let me appoint a senior officer or some former officer or former commissioner or something to look into this. He doesn't trust anyone who comes from the police. He understands that he needs someone who's completely external to look into
this.
You
know what else
he
said?
When the chief of the police
says
that.
You know what else he said? He said they should look into what happened before my tenure as chief of police. So that's also telling that he doesn't want to, you know, I mean, he's trying to say, oh, this isn't my fault. I had nothing to do with it.
Everybody needs a scapegoat.
Yeah.
And in this country, we're never hard at finding people to throw stuff at and throw under the bus.
Yeah.
Right. Which, by the way, I mean, if we're already talking about that, can I just say one thing about the decision the other day by Aviv Kochavi, the IDF chief of staff, when it came to this tragedy that took place in the elite commando unit known as Agos, right? So you're familiar with that, but just to remind our listeners, a couple weeks ago, basically a group of officers who were training somewhere in the Jordan Valley, or Judea Desert more accurately, decided to go in search of night vision goggles that they thought had been stolen by a local Bedouin tribe. And one guy went off on his own, and then another group went off on their own. They didn't know that each one had gone. They were all armed. No one was wearing helmets or any identification. The single guy, who was also an officer, opened fire at the other group and basically killed two of his colleagues, two officers, company commanders in the elite unit. So these are like some of the most elite soldiers in the IDF. A terrible disaster, really tragic. And Aviv Kohavi, the chief of staff, just the other day receives the findings from that investigation, right? In contrast to the police, this was done by a former IDF general, and decides to reprimand the deputy battalion commander, decides to reprimand one of the other officers who had gone on this expedition with the two who were killed and some other officers. But the battalion commander gets off pretty much scot-free, just a two-year delay to his promotion. Now, you add that to the fact that a couple of years ago, there was a soldier who drowned during a training exercise in a little river when the battalion, a paratrooper's battalion, was warned not to do this hike during the weather. Nothing happened to that battalion commander. And then also a couple of years ago, there was a soldier from an elite unit named Maglan who jumped off a moving Jeep into a bush, because that's what you did when you were a new soldier in this unit. And he became paralyzed, waist down. And the commander of that unit, nothing happened to him. So I'm also like, you know, why is no one paying the price for these terrible tragedies that are happening all over the place, right, in the IDF? And to me, it's just disturbing. I don't know how this connects necessarily to the NSO thing, but just another story that happened this week about accountability in this country, where, to me, severely in shortage of accountability.
I mean, I think also part of the big problem with the Egos case, which is somewhat different from the other cases, is that, you know, these people are sort of going off and doing their own thing, which you're not supposed to do in the Army. And I'm not blaming them, but it seemed, from, you know, what I'd been hearing about this situation, that like there's like a culture in Egos of, you know, taking initiative, but too much initiative, sort of not asking the questions and not asking the officers that you're supposed to ask. And I was listening to one radio interview, and they were comparing it to the Palmach. Usually we hear the Palmach in a good way, right? But the Palmach had to be dissolved because they weren't answering to the IDF chain of command, right? So that was a comparison I had heard.
Yeah, but that was a little different back in a time when we had...
No, of course. That's what I'm saying. It was a negative comparison. They're
exactly
saying that
they need to... I think that what we have going on here, unfortunately, is a bad culture in some of these units. It's a bad culture also in the police. And that's what really needs to be reformed at the core, is the culture and the respect for democracy, whether it's in the police but also within the IDF, is that old boys club has got to be broken up. People do have to pay a personal price when these types of tragedies happen, because what you're basically, you know, I don't want to sound too harsh, but the body bags are collecting on the 14th floor of the IDF headquarters just outside the office of Aviv Kohavi in Tel Aviv. I mean, it's under his tenure with these tragedies that are happening, and to keep on letting these people off without paying a price is also a problem.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know. You know, the problems with Israel this week are many, but you're also looking to outside of Israel, to Vienna, more specifically, where the nuclear talks continue. And you actually had a briefing this week with Prime Minister Bennett, where he shared some of Israel's own thinking. And Israel's National Security Council Chief Eyal Hulata is probably in D.C. as we're speaking. So where do things stand? I mean, and there was that talk, obviously, the phone call between Biden and Bennett this week. So what's the latest on the Iran front?
So most of the Bennett-Biden call was about Iran. Nobody is admitting it or saying it publicly, but it seems to me that Biden was calling Bennett because the talks are going to wrap up, you know, so you wanted to, you know, give Bennett a heads up and take that extra courtesy of the president doing it, because it's the end of the talks. And there are a bunch of diplomats who are saying publicly that they think this week is going to be the end, the final round of the talks, that they already have a draft ready. You know, it's supposed to be a return to the JCPOA in its original format with slight changes to reflect the passage of time, but not to make it any longer, not to make it touch on any other issues other than uranium enrichment. And Israel's very, very concerned about this. You know, that Israel was supportive when the U.S. was talking about a longer, stronger deal. But the feeling in Jerusalem is, first of all, that they're basically losing the benefits of the JCPOA, because within 3 years, there won't be snapback sanctions. Snapback sanctions are the option to put the sanctions back if Iran violates the deal. So as far as Hulata and Bennett are concerned, like, the Iran deal ends in 3 years. Technically, it ends in 2030, but without any enforcement, they're skeptical that there's going to be any benefit. So there's that. And then the other part of the deal is that the U.S. is going to lift a lot of sanctions. Iran is demanding that the U.S. lift all the sanctions that former President Trump put on Iran after 2018. The U.S. is saying they're not going to lift all of them. I think the U.S. wants to keep the ones that are about human rights and terrorism and say lift the ones that are related to the nuclear program. So we'll see how that ends up. But either way, it'll be a huge cash influx into Iran.
Can I ask a question? I mean, you know, the way it seems is that it's a fait accompli, right? You know, the deal's going to happen. And like you mentioned, that's why Biden and Bennett spoke. And you also wrote in one of your articles that this was really the first phone conversation between the two, maybe since they first met, right? I don't recall exactly when else they spoke, right? They met in D.C. in the summer, then they met in Glasgow at that environment conference, right? The climate thing. But this might have been their first phone call. So clearly it was important. Okay. Now, Bennett tried to portray, at least, that, that Biden is greenlighting or acknowledging Israel's right to do whatever it needs to do in the future. How much of that is real, or is that just bluster on Israel's part? Do you really foresee a possibility that once there's a deal, Israel's going to go and do something to stop it or scuttle it?
Well, okay. So when you say how much is real, I mean, first of all, Biden at least said the White House readout acknowledged Israel's freedom to act, which I think is something that hasn't been done yet sort of in this administration. And maybe they did it during the war in May, but that's in a different context. And so Biden is really acknowledging it. It's not just Bennett's sort of a wishful thinking. That being said, I don't think the deal is going to be signed and then you're going to have like Israeli Air Force bombing nuclear sites. Bennett is talking more about, I think, continuing the kinds of operations we saw under the Netanyahu, where there were all kinds of, you know, hacking and sabotage and things like that. But also, Bennett keeps sort of talking about how all of Israel's problems on its borders, whether it's Syria, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's Gaza, actually come from Iran. They're getting their money from Iran. And so Bennett wants to try to strike at that core, he calls it the head of the octopus, as opposed to the tentacles, right? So that's the idea that Bennett is focused on now. And as far as he's concerned, it doesn't matter whether there's a deal or not. If there's a deal, Iran will have a lot more money to use to attack and harass Israel. But either way, whether there's a deal or not, this problem stands, and that's what he wants to confront right now. How Israel is actually going to confront the nuclear program is something that they're not telling journalists. And we've discussed in the past that it's you can't just bomb it the way you could in Syria or in Iraq. So it's a much more complicated issue.
Oh, much more complicated. How are my friends the Chinese doing in the in the talks in Vienna? Are they playing a big role? I say my friends a little facetiously.
Yeah, well, I'll answer your question, and then I think our readers would like to know why they're your friends. But China is mostly quiet about the Iran stuff. They don't make a lot of public statements the way basically all the other parties to the talks do. That being said, the U.S. just signed a sanctions waiver for dealing with certain parts of Iran's nuclear program, nuclear research, and has not been enforcing sanctions when it comes to Iran's oil exports to China. And as we discussed with Carice Whitty a few weeks ago, you know, that China and Iran have this huge cooperation agreement. It includes defense cooperation. It includes selling a lot of oil to China. So, you know, I think they want a deal as soon as possible so they can continue doing as much business as possible. But Yaakov, tell us about the email you got.
You know, we get a lot of letters. The Chinese are never too happy with any. They're very sensitive, right? So anytime there's something that's a little critical, and we've been publishing a number of pieces in recent weeks ahead of the Olympics, and is now as they're going on in Beijing, the Winter Olympics. People have been critical. We had one op-ed which was written by a longtime contributor, Emily Schrader, called them the Genocide Olympics. So maybe, you know, you could argue, did she go too far? Did she not? I'm not even getting into that. But the Chinese, a diplomat at the embassy here in Israel, sent me a letter which begins with, I hope this letter finds you well. So that was probably the only positive part of it. But basically goes through how we're spreading vicious slander against China. We're being malicious against China. And at the end of the letter, uses the following terms, and I'll leave it to our listeners to decide if this is some sort of veiled threat or not, but it goes like this. It is contemptible that the articles were full of the Cold War mentality and ideological prejudice without even looking into the truth. People would ask what forces are behind this to support the long-term groundless and malicious attacks on China. We warn those forces who smear China and undermine China-Israel-friendly ties, justice shall always prevail. Their scheme will never succeed. So apparently, I need to be on the lookout for justice prevailing somewhere. And that our scheme will not succeed. I don't know what scheme that is, besides for trying to tell stories and provide and serve as a platform and allow the Jerusalem Post to serve as a platform.
And let's say highlighting atrocities that are happening in the world and people should be trying harder to put an end to. I mean, I don't think Emily was exaggerating at all. I think this is the closest you're going to get to the 1936 Olympics in Germany. They have, you know, 1 million to 2 million Uyghurs, which is a Muslim minority, in concentration camps, in forced labor camps.
Yeah.
And, you know, among their many other just human rights violations against their own population and other minority groups in their country. I think that they deserve all the criticism. I think that it's a shame on the world and on the Olympics that they're taking place with hardly any impact, any difference.
No one's saying anything also. That's what's incredible.
I mean,
remember Enes Kanter.
Well, like the athletes are afraid to say things.
They're afraid. And the Enes Kanter, we had him on the podcast, about a month or two ago. And he has been highlighting, now he goes by the name Enes Friedman. Freedom, sorry.
Yes.
Right. And he's talking about just the amounts of money that are at play and how huge American corporations are afraid to say anything. It's terrible what's going on. It really is in face of a modern form of genocide and atrocities, and no one is speaking up. And instead of the Chinese embracing a debate, this is what they try to do. Okay, so they sent us a letter.
It was clearly very effective because, you know, it's really stopped us from criticizing them.
Yes. We're not talking about them on the podcast, and I didn't tweet about it on Twitter. But we're going to publish the letter. I mean, you know, I believe in giving people the platform, so they want to write those things about us. We'll publish it, too. That's all good. You know, everything is I'm willing to be fair, but I also think that they have to recognize that this is what happens when you're talking to media in what we still hope, getting back to the NSO story, is still a democratic country. Lahav, before we go, tell us about our guest this week. I think our listeners will really enjoy this one.
Yes, this is a very cool guest. We have David Draiman, the lead singer of Disturbed, which is a heavy metal group that's been around for the past 25 years or so, and they've had a bunch of huge hit songs. And why do we have a heavy metal singer on our podcast is because David Draiman is Jewish and comes from an Israeli family, went to religious schools, and he's become a super, super outspoken supporter of Israel.
And but he's become more active lately.
He
mentions that also in the interview, how he just can't. He couldn't sit quietly anymore. What he's been seeing and hearing, whether it was the Amnesty report or recently calling Israel an apartheid state or other matters and other events, he's just had enough, and he's using his platforms and his position to try to change the way people think about Israel and the Jewish people.
Yeah, and we were really excited to have him on. I think he spoke really beautifully. I think he said really touching things and also just gave us a lot to think about. I mean, he painted a pretty bleak picture of the way Israel and Jews are seen by the world. He's not wrong. And I think you'll find it very interesting to hear what he has to say.
One of my claims to fame is he does not know who I am. I mean, until we spoke, but I grew up about a block and a half away from him on the same street in Chicago. So, back then he was just a guy he's a few years older going to school, but pretty cool that, the famous nice. David Draymond. Yeah. Yeah. So here we go. Great interview with the Disturbed David Draymond.
On this week's podcast, we have a very special guest, David Draymond, the lead singer of Disturbed. And no, this is not a big shift in topic for our podcast. We're not here to review like metal music, but we are here to talk about Israel because David Draymond, for many years now, has been an outspoken Israel supporter, and we're very excited to have him on the show. So welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So could you tell us a little bit about your background and how that's, I guess, contributed to you being so vocally supportive of Israel?
Well, my family has lived in Israel since the early 1900s. My grandmother's family on my father's side immigrated there from Yemen. Their whole side are Yemenite Jews, and his family came over from Poland. I have, with my grandfather and my father, two generations of Tzanchanim, commando paratroopers in the IDF. My family built the now vacant Jerusalem Pearl Hotel, which stands right outside the Jaffa Gate in Jerusalem. My grandfather used to be the editor, and I have about 2,000 relatives residing in the state of Israel, maybe more.
Wow. 2,000 relatives. That's pretty amazing.
That's a lot of Israelis and a lot of Jews. But David, you know, I can imagine, though, and maybe I'm wrong, but in your line of business, you're the front singer for a very popular, you're a famous singer for a very popular heavy metal band. I can imagine that there are some people who are attracted to your music, who come to your sold out concerts, who don't see eye to eye with you on Israel, who maybe don't even like Jews for that matter. I mean, does that ever come up?
It has. The wonderful thing about music, and I've said this time and time again, is that it brings people of all walks of life and all beliefs together. And it is a means of uniting people and enabling people to share their to enjoy their shared humanity and forget about the labels and the politics that are often associated with us as individuals. There have been on occasion people protesting. You know, we've had our share of, over the years, and I can maybe count it on one hand, where, you know, skinheads would show up or things of that nature. But for the most part, we've been very, very lucky in that our concert environments have been relatively free of that sort of thing. Now, whether or not anybody within the fan base or the crowds is either an Israel supporter or not,
for sure, yeah.
Requirement to participate in the event, for sure. But you know, it's difficult sometimes knowing how much, you know, animosity exists for not only our people but for the state of Israel, and that has been continuing to build and perpetuate over the course of the past 15 to 20 years specifically. I mean, I've seen tangible changes over the course of my career and my life. And I felt the need to return to social media on a more public level because of how bad things have gotten.
What have you noticed specifically?
Oh, God. The number of blatant, public, unapologetic attacks that have occurred in the particular of late, particularly over the course of the past 3 to 5 years, really hit a nerve with me. Jews are attacked on the streets of New York City, whether it's Brooklyn or anywhere else, almost on a daily or regular basis at this point. The attacks occur in Los Angeles. They occur in southern Florida. They occur all over the place. It's insane how gotten over the course of the past number of years. And they've been emboldened from several factors, from a world that has become increasingly demonizing of not only Israel, but of Jews in general. There's nothing like a good pandemic to make all the conspiracy theorists of the world foam at the mouth at the opportunity to blame the Jewish people again for some aspect of their suffering. It's just a very, very frightening time to me. And being a parent in this world to a child of a mixed family that consists of two of the demographics that probably currently are the most attacked, Jews and Asians, I felt very compelled to try and see if I could once again utilize this platform that I've been blessed with and follow my conscience a little bit more. So that it was the LEK incident, actually, the terror attack that occurred in Jerusalem some months ago, that was kind of a straw that broke the camel's back, that drew me back into things, so to speak.
And you came and you visited Israel and you went through the old city to see exactly where LEK was shot.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what that was like, what that felt like for you?
It was very surreal, and it didn't feel any different other than the fact of having the knowledge of what occurred. I mean, I had walked that path through the Shuk to the Kotel so many times, hundreds of times. That was just the more direct, the shorter way to get there. And realizing what had occurred and where it had occurred, it was very jarring to me to know that it occurred in an area that always felt so relatively safe. The number of times I had walked that path, I had never felt like I was in danger. I had never felt that, anybody else would be. One of the things that was at least somewhat reassuring is that when we actually had the demonstration right there at the site of the attack, a number of the other Arab shop owners that are there in the Shuk came up to me. And, I don't know how much of it was sincere. I can only judge by the impression I got. And my impression was that it was sincere. And everyone that came up to me was very apologetic and wanted to separate themselves from the extremist elements that obviously are very, very dominant in the culture. And that was refreshing. But more than anything else, it was important, I guess, not only for our people, but on a selfish level for myself to not be intimidated and to walk that path again and to make sure that, the people who are seeking out to intimidate us, to frighten us into submission, don't get the satisfaction.
Yeah, it's interesting because you were talking about the Arab shopkeepers. When I saw a video of that, I was on Israel's public broadcaster, Khan, and the news reporter who had done that report was also a Arab man, very talented journalist. And I thought that it...
Yes.
you know, it says a lot, I think, about the character of Israel and sort of the ability to sort of move on and try to coexist anyway, despite, you know, such a terrible, terrible tragedy that happened. When I was Googling this incident or this trip of yours to prepare for this interview, I noticed one of the links was that you lost thousands of Instagram followers, which is whatever. Okay, so what? But
it was a momentary blip, to be honest. I mean, I'm back now above. I have more Instagram followers now than I ever had.
Right. So I mean, that was just my.
I gained them back and then some, you know, so it's
that was my way of asking you more. Just what were the reactions
in terms of comments made, or in terms of negative comments made, you mean, or just in general?
In general, what was the impression? How do you think people responded to your visit and to your message?
Oh, I was overwhelmed by, you know, just the level of positivity and the level of encouragement that I got. You know, that certainly wasn't the reason I did it, but it was nice to know that so many people felt the same way that I did. And so many people had a common sense of outrage. You know, Jerusalem in general and the old city in general, I used to treasure, you know, walking the streets of the old city. It had always been such a perfect symbol of coexistence to me. You know, seeing how all the different sects exist among one another and for events like the LEK incident to shatter that temporarily, it angered me. You know, I don't think that, you know, I think that we owe it to ourselves and to each other and to the growing negative perception that the world perpetuates of our people and our homeland, to show them consistently that they're wrong, that it's simply, you know, falsehoods and slander, literally. I mean, making reference to what you guys brought up earlier, mm-hmm. the Amnesty report, or the Human Rights Watch report, or any number of reports, or the ICC. Institutional anti-Semitism exists, and it's terrifying to see how far it's come. It's terrifying to see the types of individuals that have penetrated these quote-unquote human rights organizations, who are so solely fixated on the one beacon of democratic hope in the Middle East, as opposed to truly going after the monsters of this world. You know, they don't, if they spent a fraction of the energy they do demonizing us, exposing the true abusers of the world, if they spent a fraction of the time going after China, who is now, you know, despite all they've done and despite all they continue to do and their oppression.
For sure.
Every major business in the United States and throughout the world continuing to still do regular business with them. And, you know, it's interesting how neither China nor Russia nor Venezuela nor any of the actual countries who are actually sitting currently on the Human Rights Council, who are some of the worst human rights abusers in the world, none of them do these organizations have the level of venom and vitriol and, you know, just zeal that they have when going after Jews. And that should scare the hell out of everyone.
David, I'm curious, you know, you work in the entertainment industry, and just a week ago was the Whoopi Goldberg incident on the show The View. And obviously mm-hmm. these are different mediums, and, you know, The View is daytime TV. You're a rock star. But I am curious, you know, within the industry, what she did say spoke of this a massive ignorance about what the Holocaust was, right? About what anti-Semitism is. How often do you come across people who the public look up to as these personalities who actually know something, and you encounter that type of ignorance and just plain stupidity?
It's fairly widespread, unfortunately, and it's tremendous failure of our current systems that are in place, and the fact that, you know, we have failed on Holocaust education. We have failed on teaching the accurate history of the formation of the State of Israel. We have failed on teaching the accurate history of our own people, not to our own people, but to the people who claim to know something about Jews. You know, we're so focused internally, almost to a massive detriment. I shouldn't say almost, to a massive detriment. Our social media, the State of Israel's social media presence, the Jewish people's social media presence. We spend so much time fighting each other and trying to position ourselves for more space than the other guy, or more funding than the other guy, or more visibility than the other guy. It's a shit show. It's embarrassing. The level to which our enemies are united in their hatred of us and in their persecution of us and in their continued demonization of us. And then to see to the extent to which we consistently fail just to teach the basic elements of who we are and where we come from is unforgivable. It really, truly is. I mean, and it's become even polarized within our own communities. And there's no justification for it.
David, on that note of what we were talking about, Holocaust denial and anti-Semitism, there's recent, and I saw that you've tweeted about this also, in our old hometown of Chicago, West Rogers Park, there's been a spate recently of anti-Semitic incidents against Tel Aviv Bakery and other places.
Free Synagogue and a number of other places. I've been following it very closely.
What is it about people who, in your view, just still don't get it, that still think that this is okay?
I don't think that they think it's okay. They don't care whether it's okay or not. They don't want our permission.
Right.
they could care less. All they're looking for is a scapegoat. And the Jews have always been the scapegoats for every evil that exists in the world to certain people. You know, like I said, there was nothing that could have possibly been a worse incubator, or a more effective incubator, I should say, for hatred and fomenting anti-Semitism than the past 2 years of this pandemic. You get people stripped of normalcy, stripped of their livelihoods, stripped of family and community, and they want to blame someone. They want to blame something, and they go back to the world's oldest hatred. You know, all of a sudden, you know, the protocols of the elders of Zion reappears on, you know, in bookstores in certain parts of the world. All of a sudden, you know, the forces that are constantly campaigning against us manage to gain more strength. All of a sudden, there's even more hate crimes. Look at what's happened specifically over the course of the past 2 years under the microscope. And you can see tangible, you know, evidence backed up by numbers of how bad it's gotten because of what we're all going through. It's the scapegoat factor. The people who hate Jews, or who are inclined to hate Jews, or hate someone, or want to blame someone for why everything that's bad in their life is happening, this is how they behave. And the ignorance is perpetuated by lack of education, by lack of any sort of accountability. And it's made even worse by people getting away with committing these crimes time and time again. Part of what has occurred politically in our cities over the course of the past number of years has been the weakening of penalties for violent crimes, for all sorts of aspects of enforcement. And you have people committing hate crimes and attacking Jews on the street one day, and they're let out of jail a couple days later, or that very same day at times. And there's no real repercussions. It's like they've been given permission. You know,
right.
I can't recall a more perfect storm of events. Everything has been, you know, contributing to this, you know, inferno that we're currently dealing with.
You know, you were talking about the Jewish community being divided and not having a very good response.
We're horrible at it, Lahav. We're absolutely abysmal at it. You know,
yes.
There's so many egos. There's so much me, me, me. There's so much, you know, people are jockeying for speaking engagements and this and that and whatever. You know what? If we were smart, okay, and I give so much to so many people. I don't advertise it, but I do. You know, my philanthropic pursuits are gargantuan. All right. And it's still not enough. If we were smart, okay, we would pool a whole bunch of funds in one massive fund, and people could apply for grants to the thing based on their level of activism and their activity. We don't do anything like that. We expect everybody to be warriors. We expect them to do it out of the goodness of their heart. And we create this competitive space that shouldn't be a competition to begin with. Like, I mean, look at, for example, the anti-Israel coalition of people that find the means, no matter what, to join forces together and to battle against us. They're so well organized. They are so well united. They understand how to truly utilize social media and how to really get campaigns together. Us, we try to get 100 people together for one simple demonstration, and it's a miracle.
Yeah, but David, for every one of you who's like a celebrity, a star, there's maybe 1,000 of them, right? Who are stars, celebrities, who are against Israel, for every one of you who's in favor of Israel.
Yeah, I don't know that that's the case, to be honest. First of all, whether you're a celebrity or not shouldn't make a difference, but I know to many it does.
An influencer, someone who influences public opinion.
No, for sure. But here's the thing, okay? And this is the source of the problem, is that one side is consistently rewarded and the other side is consistently punished. That's the issue, because the people who might want to be more vocal about their support, they know that they're engaging, you know, the mob, and the mob is very, very well organized. You know, look, thankfully, I've reached a point in my career where I really don't give a shit anymore. Somebody wants to go ahead and cast their stones at me. They know that I'm very, very careful about separating what I do as a musician from who I am as an individual. And if they can't come to terms with that, then that's their problem. I honestly don't see people not coming to our shows because I'm continuing to talk about something that they've already known for 2 decades. You know what I mean? I don't care. I've made my money. We have our band. I know they know who I am. I know who they are. And they love us for it regardless. But there are many who don't have that luxury, and or they don't at least feel that they have that luxury, because the level of organized, unified, passionate outcry that occurs from the organized social media space and from the media in general, who the majority of the mainstream media are very much along with the anti-Israel narrative, it can be deafening, and it's incredibly intimidating to most people. So what I would say, Yaakov, is that the numbers are there, they just are not vocal. And the numbers that exist on the other side are extraordinarily vocal. That's the problem. And those on the other side, even if you don't know who the hell they are, they want their 5 minutes of fame. All they have to do is make some sort of statement against Israel. And suddenly every single publication puts them on their page and everybody suddenly realizes who these people are just because they decided to jump on board the hate train. And they're rewarded for it. On the other side of that, on the flip side of the equation, anybody that chooses to try and voice their support for our people, for Israel, or for Jews in general, is for the most part either ignored or condemned heavily. Ignored if you're lucky. Condemned heavily is the vast majority of people. And in the entertainment space in particular, you know, for many people, the push just isn't worth the squeeze. You know, they don't see anything real coming from their efforts to try and support. People are lackadaisic about it. I mean, for example, look at the embarrassment that was our get together in D.C. just last year. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Shanda. On every level. Disgusting. We are lazy. We need a fire lit collectively under our respective asses. Because when something like that happens on the other side, every single member of the community on the other side of this thing goes. And they make the time and they make themselves heard and they get their bodies out there and they get their voices raised out there. And then they garner the attention of the media who are just dying and salivating at the next opportunity to cover something like that. We have failed miserably and we continue to fail because for many of us here in the diaspora who have been able to be so detached up until now, up until the past 2 years in particular, where violence has become the norm on the big cities of the United States against Jews, the complacency and detachment, people don't feel invested. Not only that, but they feel that if they do invest themselves, that they're going to be dealing with backlash on their own. You know, all the elements that created a society that thought, you know, and they were wrong when they thought this, but thought that assimilating into European and German culture would save them from Hitler's wrath, are going to be getting a very large, and they're in the midst of getting a very large wake-up call. The problem is the majority of them are too scared, or they're just not bothering to wake up.
So what do you think that the, like, organized Jewish community or pro-Israel organizations could be doing to bring people together and to relay a stronger message?
I think that all of us need to unite. Every organization needs to get together, needs to be together. We have to stop demonizing each other. Look, you know something? There's a lot of guys who do what we do in their own particular style, or they do it with a partisan spin. The level of separation is disgusting and reprehensible. And the virtue signaling that exists among our own people and the bias that exists within the articles that we ourselves write, trying to protect ourselves, is reprehensible. I may not be the biggest fan of everything the ADL does, okay? There's many things I disagree with them on, but I will never shit on them because they are the only organization who can actually take the microphone in a CNN interview and who will be listened to. They have the power. They've gotten to that point. So even if, and I'll give you an example, I can't understand nor make sense of, nor can I rationalize the different versions of the actual of the meaning of racism that have come into play over the course of just the past couple weeks within the organization. Okay. But you cannot deny that. Agree with them on everything or not, like them about everything or not. They are at least a mouthpiece. And Jonathan, I've had my disagreements with him, but he has made me proud of late of a number of the things that he's been doing and how well he's been speaking, particularly in light of what happened on The View. You know, it was a moment for all of us to realize, you know what? we all have our things that we pledge allegiance to. We all have our own internal biases. We all have our own internal partisan aspects to ourselves. But when it comes to defending ourselves and defending our people, that is garbage. People are way too like crazy about it. And everybody needs to leave the partisan stuff behind. They need to leave the jockeying for positions for speaking engagements behind. They need to stop self-promoting and they need to start promoting everyone. Everyone should be sharing each other's articles. Everyone should be sharing each other's message. We should be getting together as organizations and having group discussions on a regular basis of how to focus our efforts. And it's not, you know, rocket science. It's 101. The other side gets it. We don't. And we're suffering and people are being hurt as a result of it. Right? I think that, you know, Sinat Chinam is what destroyed the temple. Hatred of ourselves amongst our own people. Our own people.
Those are some powerful words, David, really. And we want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing them with us and with our listeners. And
of course,
we you know, just to watch you and to read you on Twitter and see what you're posting and Instagram. I don't think people should take that for granted. So thank you very much, David Draiman, the lead singer for the band Disturbed, who has 2,000 plus relatives in the land of Israel. That's the bigger thing.
And Lahav, by the way, I have tremendous respect for you in particular and everything you do. You are an incredibly respectable and powerful voice out there.
Thank you so much.
Don't think that I don't see it and appreciate it, because I do and many like me do. Again, for the both of you, the vast majority, okay, of the quiet majority, the silent majority, okay, are behind us, even within the spheres of thought that we think don't welcome us. You really should know that. The problem is that extremist voices are the loudest and they are amplified the most.
Right.
I still have tremendous hope in the fact that the vast majority of the American people, for example, are still behind us and still want to defend and protect us and for us to keep us safe as much as we want to defend and protect them. And so, you know, there still is a shared sense of community, of family, and of unity. It's the extremists that can really get under our skin and that unfortunately end up causing more trouble than they're worth. Let's not forget that when we are united and when we are combined, that we are stronger than they are.
Right.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you, guys. You have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please send it to your friends and family. We are available on all the major podcasting platforms, and we'll be back next week.